Hey, it's Anna Sale, and I want to thank you for listening to Death, Sex, and Money, where I explore the big questions and hard choices that are often left out of polite conversation. You can hear new episodes ad-free every week on Amazon Music, where you can find Death, Sex, and Money and all of your Slate favorites without the ads.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
Hey, it's Anna. A quick announcement. If you live in New York City or you can be there on the afternoon of Saturday, December 9th, join us for a live event celebrating the end of this era of death, sex, and money at WNYC. We're doing a live show called Four Interviews and a Funeral with special guests, music, and a communal celebration of endings. It's at 12:30 p.m. at a cabaret on the Lower East Side called Caveat, which is appropriate because the caveat for this event is that we don't know yet what is happening next for the show, me or the team, but we do know something special is coming to an end. Ticket information is at the link in our show notes, or you can visit caveat.nyc/events. Please come out if you can. I also want to give you a heads up about this episode. It's about two married people, one of whom lives with a serious mental illness, and how they deal with that in their family. As we talk, there is conversation about thoughts of suicide, so please take care while listening.
Mommy has an illness of the mind, because it's easier than mental illness. So I say mommy has an illness of the mind, and sometimes mommy has to go to the hospital to get better.
This is Death, Sex, and Money. The show from WNYC about the things we think about a lot and need to talk about more. I'm Anna Sale. It had been 8.5 years since Julia Lukacs had a manic episode. In that time, she had a baby, changed jobs, and her husband Mark had written a memoir about their experience together, called My Lovely Wife in the Psych Ward. Danger seemed behind them.
And we kind of had this quasi-pseudoscience theory that maybe by sharing our story with the world, that was becoming this like protective barrier for us, that we had like reclaimed the narrative and were figuring it out and standing side by side. And this was like protecting us and all this other stuff. And then it's like, well, I guess that theory is not real because it happened again.
I first interviewed Mark and Julia on the show back in 2015. We're going to play some of that original conversation and then hear more from my recent conversation with them, which was recorded in the beginning of fall of this year. Julia had just spent the whole summer recovering from a psychotic episode, her fourth ever. Julia described her first psychotic episode in our original interview. When that happened, she was 27 and had just started working at a new place.
I was only a week or two into this new job, and I would look at an email I would receive, and I'm very efficient. I usually, you know, write back, respond. I'm doing a million different things. And for some reason, this time around, I would just look at the email and just stare at the email and reread my response 10 times and call Mark and read him my response before hitting send. I would just blank stare at the wall, and people, I remember, looking at me like, what's going on?
And Mark, when did you notice that this wasn't just stress of starting a new job?
I mean, within the first week, it was clear that the stuff she was complaining about was sort of bigger than just, oh, this is a busy job, you know, where I was like, maybe this isn't actually what we thought it was going to be. I recognize looking back, like I was pretty impatient and could get pretty easily frustrated. Like, what's going on? Why are you so freaked out? Stop calling me. I'm at work. I got to do my job too.
Julia went to a doctor and was prescribed an antidepressant, but she didn't get better.
What made it real was when I was given the pills and I was on Skype with my mom, and I told her, I was like, Mom, I think I'm going to just take all these pills and I think I'm going to commit suicide. Hmm. Yeah. And that was just within like a month. It just spiraled so quickly.
Julia was eventually diagnosed with bipolar disorder. People with it experience extreme emotional highs and extreme lows. And in Julia's case, even the highs could get really dark.
That's one of the big distinctions they've made, where like usually mania is super fun and you're up late and partying, but your mania is just like really scary and psychotic.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing she could talk about was the devil, and that she basically needed to protect the world because the devil was inside her. And so she didn't specifically say, like, I am going to kill myself, but it was basically like her being alive was keeping the devil alive.
And then what do they tell you at the ER?
I still was under this impression that a doctor was going to walk in the doors and say, okay, here's exactly what's going on, and here's this pill. And as soon as she takes it, it's like taking a Tylenol for a headache. She'll be totally fine within an hour, no problem. And that was like such a naive expectation. But it's what we thought. And that is like not at all what happened. Instead, the doctor came in and said, we have no idea what's going on. She's clearly dangerous. So we can't keep her here in the ER. We're going to take her to the psychiatric facility where she's going to stay for a minimum of 72 hours because that's what the law mandates. And then after that, they'll reevaluate if she needs to stay for longer.
At what point did you hear the words psychosis or psychotic break?
I think I remember it most clearly when I was put next to the nurse station because I was completely psychotic. And that's what I remember the nurse saying. It's like, this girl is completely psychotic and she needs to stay like right here next to us, basically. That's kind of like the room where the craziest of crazies like stays because they just didn't trust me anywhere else in the ward. So yeah, I think it was very much early on.
And it wasn't said to you, it was said about you.
It was about me. Yeah. I was right there in the room looking over, like completely lost and confused. And they were like, that psychotic girl needs to stay right there.
She did stay there for 23 days. Mark was at home, frantically making phone calls to doctors, to the insurance company, to his job, trying to manage as best he could until visiting hours from 7 to 8:30 each night.
And so it was literally like spent all day on the phone and then gear yourself up to go visit her, not knowing what the hell's going to happen when I get there. You know, like any range of Julia being super affectionate, or Julia like screaming at me to not come in her door, or Julia just ignoring me. I mean, like it was completely unpredictable. I'd have to prepare things to talk about because Julia didn't necessarily, all she'd want to talk about is like the angels and demons that were in the world. And I'm like, oh, well, the weather was nice today. Let's talk about who I talked to my brother, and just trying to like keep her in this reality somehow.
Julia, I heard you giggle a little bit when Mark said the visiting hours and not knowing what to expect.
Yeah. I just look back at all the stuff I said during those visiting hours and like what I believed, and I still remember it all so vividly, but I'm not in that state of mind anymore. So I could see how for him it was like so scary. But for me, it was reality. Like I believed the whole all the nurses were actors and they all like set up this huge scheme against me. And this was going to be like how I would like get to heaven, is to figure this all out. It was all a game. And I would tell Mark, you know, like, ha, I get it now. Yeah. This nurse is playing this person. And he was just like, you know, the center of the plot. Because that's what I believed. I believed that he was out to get me, and he was one of the bad guys.
After Julia got out of the hospital, she was enrolled in an outpatient rehab program where she had a support group, art therapy, yoga. Her husband Mark took a 3-year leave from work to help with the transition, but it ended up being 9 months before she was feeling better. Julia remembers it as the hardest time of her life.
I was just so suicidal, and I was like, why would God do this to me? Like, why would he abandon me? And why would he get me to go through all of this? Basically, I believed I was in hell, so why would I have to go through hell in this lifetime? I've always been a good person. Like, he doesn't love me.
And how did you feel about Mark during that 9-month period?
He was a lot of times the pill Nazi. That's the way I called him for a little bit. Basically, he was like, take your pills, take your pills, take your pills, you know? And there were times where I took myself off the pills because, I mean, one specific pill, I gained 70 pounds in 6 weeks. I mean, it's horrible, like, what some of these pills do to you. And I just, and some of them are, like, so mind-numbing, and I couldn't live that way. I still was like, I'm a human being, you know? And so we were not connected at all because he hadn't experienced it. And he always sided with the doctors and the medications, and I needed him to side with me. Looking back, obviously, it's so hard, you know, to have what he experienced as well. It's just such a hard role to play the caregiver to your own wife.
Yeah, Mark, what do you... When she was released into your care from the hospital, what did they tell you your responsibility was?
Basically to, like, not let her die, you know? They said, you got to keep her safe, and she has to take her medication. Because if she's not taking her medication, you can't keep her at home. She's going to have to go back in the hospital. Yeah, it was just, it was really tough, you know? And it's tough to hear Julia say this stuff now, because I really, you know, when she says stuff like, I'm the devil, then I can't take her literally anymore, you know? I just couldn't. It's not to say that I didn't trust her, but I guess I kind of didn't trust her. And so when she's saying, like, you don't know how these pills make me feel, it was really easy for me to say, you're right, I don't, but it's worth it, because you're not thinking you're the devil anymore, and you're not actively trying to throw yourself out of a moving car. But that's because I didn't have to take those pills. And the problem is since this was her first time, she had no baseline understanding of how medication impacted her. And so they didn't know what meds were going to work and what meds weren't going to work. And so it was this, like, long drawn out science experiment of, okay, let's try these pills for 3 weeks. Oh, they didn't work. Okay, let's just switch them out.
So Mark, this is a difficult question, but during that period, did you fantasize about leaving the marriage?
You know, the reality is no, I did not, because it just felt like it was too intense to leave. But after, when things got normal, then you just start to bicker about who did the laundry and this little stuff, this little crap, basically. That's where I was like, what's going on here? Like, that's where I started to get more frustrated with the marriage, where I was like, don't you realize, like, what I did to help you, and how much I love you, and how much I sacrificed to try to take care of you? And I got really frustrated for a while, you know, where I just didn't feel like it was reciprocated. Not that I was fantasizing leaving the marriage, but I think that's where the the impact, the negative impact on our marriage really came to life. And we had to just navigate the normal things that couples confront with this very unbalanced power dynamic. It was really sloppy and we fought about it a lot.
And Julia, it sounds like you were frustrated with Mark because you felt like you'd had this profound experience that he was totally outside of. He just couldn't understand.
Yeah. I mean, he was not in a psych ward and I will never be the same. I just, you know, this changed me forever, you know, and so I see the world differently. It's like, yeah, like I'm sure the world is beautiful and everything happens for a reason. Well, you know, you're on the other side of that spectrum. It's really tough to come to terms with that it's you that is going to be the one suffering and questioning your life and questioning your existence. And I don't think, I thankfully met a lot of friends that experienced similar journeys that I did, that I was able to grasp onto during these last 5 years that have really helped save me.
Can you tell me about the decision? How did you decide to start a family with Mark?
So that was like, I've always wanted to be a mom. Actually, before my first episode, I remember going off birth control, like literally that summer. And then I got sick and everything changed. And I remember my mom visiting me in the hospital and me telling her, Mom, I'm never going to be a mom. I'm never going to get to be a mom. And she's like, what are you talking about? And I said, no, like, this is my life. This is what I'm going to be. I'm going to be in psych wards and I'm sick and I'm not going to be a mom. And I think after it was after 2 years, and talking obviously very closely with my psychiatrist, my therapist, my gynecologist, that they thought it was going to be okay for me to get off the medications and try to get pregnant safely. And so we just, you know, we were blessed with this beautiful baby boy. Yeah.
Soon after her son Jonas was born, Julia had another manic episode. It was again triggered by work stress and not sleeping.
They put me on the meds and it's already too late. And I just go into my psychosis and my big thoughts of this time. I thought heaven was a place on earth and we were all, you know, just angels. So yeah, that was when Jonas was only 5 months old.
Mark said he never feared for Jonas's safety when Julia was manic, but they both felt like they weren't going to have another kid.
My psychiatrist has told me, like, probably that Jonas will be my last child, yes, because she wants to keep me on meds forever, and that would mean, you know, not having another child because you don't want to be on those meds during pregnancy, especially if the first trimester.
Ta-da! Miracles do happen, and we actually have two children.
Yes.
Jonas is now 11, and our second son, Cosimo, is 5.
This is part of a voice memo we received from Mark and Julia earlier this year, 8 years since my first conversation with them. I'd reached out when we were working on our Mental Health Call-ins series to see how they were doing, and they said, really good. Julia had not had a manic episode since we spoke. They had a second son, and Julia said she was managing her stress.
I tend to get sick from work stress, and now I work at an amazing company where we actually work out as teams during lunch break, and that has been extremely helpful, keeping me healthy and kind of maintaining my work stress.
Coming up, a few weeks after Julia sent in that voice memo, she had another episode.
When Julia was starting to go manic, Jonas noticed something. And so I talked to him, and his description was, "Mom's being really nice, but it seems like she's trying too hard to be nice right now."
Last week, I asked you to send in voice memos about how death, sex, and money has fit into your life as the team and I look ahead to the end of this era of making the show at WNYC. It has been really wonderful to hear from so many of you about how you first came upon the show and about what we've accompanied you through in life as you kept listening.
A few years ago, I had an affair with a married man, and that relationship ended horribly in all the ways that you can imagine. My sister sent me an episode of Death, Sex, and Money in which people talked about their experiences with infidelity. And listening to the stories that people shared was a lifeline for me. It made me see that the people in that episode were not monsters, and that maybe that also meant that I was not a monster.
And I was living in upstate New York, 3,000 miles from where I grew up, supporting my, at the time, boyfriend and his family. His then 21-year-old brother had just been diagnosed with a very rare fatal cancer. So everywhere I went, I just brought the whole room down, and people didn't know what to say, and their discomfort made me uncomfortable. So I just stopped talking about it. I felt like I had to be polite, less intense. So I kind of made jokes or I glossed over everything. And this show, your show, was the antithesis to that polite conversation. And it just really resonated. They really were the things I was thinking about all the time and not able to talk about enough.
Keep sending in your voice memos about your experiences with the show, how it's made you think differently about anything in your life, or how it's been a comfort, or also when we've made you laugh. I definitely love the moments in our show that have helped me take a step away from my internal drama and laugh at the absurdity life sometimes throws at you. Record a voice memo and send it to us at deathsexmoney@wnyc.org. And remember, as I said at the top of the show, while we are still figuring out what the future is going to look like for the show, for me, and for the rest of the team, that is not stopping us from celebrating what we've made so far. So if you can be in New York City on the afternoon of Saturday, December 9th, join us at Caveat, a cabaret on the Lower East Side, for a live event we're calling Four Interviews and a Funeral. There's a link to get tickets in our show notes. Let me tell you a good story. It was late on a Sunday afternoon, and my family and I had been away and rolled into the driveway, and everyone was worn out from traveling and getting hangry. But waiting for us was a solution. A Hungry Root box filled with healthy, grabbable snacks and a few different dinner meals to choose from. We tore into this thing like a pack of wild animals and ate all the snacks. But they were healthy, whole ingredients, fresh produce. And then we were set for dinner a few hours later, which only took about 15 minutes to prep and cook and get on the table. I was so grateful to my past self for doing my current self this solid by ordering this box. And it was easy. I took a short quiz to tell Hungry Root what kinds of meat my family eats, the sorts of flavors we like, any dietary restrictions we have, or just things we're trying to avoid, and when I wanted the box to be delivered. Right now, Hungry Root is offering Death, Sex, and Money listeners 40% off your first delivery and free veggies for life. Just go to hungryroot.com/DSM to get 40% off your first delivery and get your free veggies. That's hungryroot.com/DSM. And don't forget to use our link so they know we sent you.
This is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC. I'm Anna Sale. Late in the spring of 2023, Julia Lukacs was hospitalized for 17 days. I talked with her and Mark on a video call a few months later. She was back at her job in marketing. Mark joined from an empty classroom. He's a ninth grade teacher. That day's lesson, sex ed.
Literally just like hands still sticky from the rubbing alcohol that I was using to wash off the lubricant of doing demos of putting condoms on little pieces of wood. I think you all probably had different days than I did.
Unlike her other episodes, Julia had not been stressed about work. And it was springtime. The others had happened in the fall. But like the times before, Julia had started having trouble sleeping.
I was listening to a lot of meditations, like at night. I was like proactively, like always had my favorite meditation. It was Harry Styles on the Calm app.
Oh,
it was a sleep story. Yeah, it was a sleep story by Harry Styles, and he would put me to bed. And so the big thing there is once I stop sleeping, it's like go panic mode, find the antipsychotic medication and take it right away. The problem was, I think, you know, after 8.5 years, I kind of got a little bit too comfortable with the maintenance and the fact that I did not have on hand an antipsychotic at the time.
And then, despite getting an antipsychotic prescription, Julia still wasn't sleeping. Her symptoms got worse.
It was literally Mother's Day morning where we got to the threshold of like, I remember the kids came in and brought their little cards and gifts for Julia. And then they were going on a hike. And in that 30, 40 minutes that they were gone, Julia was having these very physical like shakes. And she had actually kind of stopped communicating verbally. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, I think we need to go and get emergency care to make sure she's not getting over-medicated. So the kids literally went on a hike on Mother's Day morning and came home and we were gone. Mm-hmm. And I didn't come back till like 10 hours later. And Julia obviously didn't come back.
Mm-hmm. And Mark, I guess, is there something about having, I don't know if you think of it this way, but 8.5 years is a long time. It suggests that you had figured out a med strategy and a lifestyle strategy, even through early parenting. Like, what did it feel like for you to feel like, number one, that this could come so much out of nowhere, and also that, like, the clock was resetting in a way?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was really not, it was very unwelcome to bring this back into our lives, you know? I was actually really mad. I was like, why? Why? Like, we've been doing fine. I think I projected some of that madness, that anger at what I was considering like some of the comfort that we had taken, that it was fine and we didn't have to deal with this again. I was also really mad at the timing of this. Our son, Jonas, went to this really small K-5, and like their last month of fifth grade is really, really intentional and celebratory. They perform this play and they have a really big graduation ceremony. He's a baseball player. He loves baseball. So that's like peak of baseball season. So there was just like so much happening in his life. He actually turned 11 the third day she was in the hospital. I was just really, I was just pissed off that this was so disruptive to them and their childhood. And then also to me, you know, as their father who was there wanting to support that childhood, you know? And I will say, like, I'm not mad at Julia. I was just mad that this was happening.
As Mark talked, I could see on the video call his anger at having to accept this isn't an illness he can fix for Julia and their family. And as Mark described this, I could also see Julia's pain. It was hard for her to hear the impact of her illness on her kids. She could hear this now, but Julia wanted me to understand that when she was in the grips of her episode, she was not capable of tracking things like baseball schedules. At the same time, the reason the episode felt so intense was because her illness was making her think it was up to her to protect and keep her family safe.
a lot of it has to do with, like, Mark is sleeping now and I need to protect him. So I'm going to stay up and protect him. And, like, the same thing, the kids are sleeping downstairs. Like, I need to stay up and protect my family from a harm or from evil. There's always forces of evil at play. And yeah, and it feels very real. It's like, it's not like, oh, it's a delusion. It's like, tell your mind it's not real. But for me, it's like, I am in the battlefield, like, protecting, like, humanity.
And this time, Julia said she didn't feel suspicious of Mark during her episode, as she had previously, thinking he was part of some plot against her. This time, she wanted and needed him close.
I mean, so much so that the first 2 weeks, like, I wouldn't even take my medication unless Mark would give me the medication. So the nurse would have to call Mark, and Mark would have to come and give me, like, ice cream and, like, my pills.
What do you think that shift's about?
I think we all evolve and grow from these experiences. And I think we've changed a lot. We know a lot what a hospitalization entails. And I think there's more compassion that we have towards each other, even while I'm psychotic. Like, I feel like I still have that in check.
Did you feel that, Mark?
Oh, unquestionably, yeah.
Is it difficult when you're coming out of the hospital, and I don't know if they have this assumption, but I imagine sometimes when you go to the hospital and then you come back from the hospital, the hospital ought to have fixed you. Like, how did you talk about the reentry? How did you explain
to the kids?
To them?
Mm-hmm. Mark, do you want to answer?
Yeah, I think the truth is that I mostly did the talking to that. I think that Julia came home in a very fragile, vulnerable state, and we were really glad to have her home. And we also recognized, I think the kids saw it pretty clearly, like, okay, mom is not 100%. And so I would just say, you know, we got to be gentle. Jonas understands the language of highs and lows because of bipolar. And so we've been able to shift, like, mom's now in a low state, you know? And then I think Julia was also pretty good at setting her parameters when things were overwhelming. I think this is something that I did really differently, is that in the past, if something was overwhelming for Julia, I wasn't very good at giving her the permission to step away, because I assumed that, like, we could collectively love her to recovery, you know? Yeah. But I now it's like, there was a lot of, okay, mom would eat dinner and then she would just go lay in bed, and we would give her the space and close the door and not bother her, or go sit outside for a while, and, like, not drawing attention to it, just letting Julia have that space.
I have kind of a big, big question in, that I was sort of thinking about, because I feel like this episode was confirmation for you all that, yes, in fact, Julia has a chronic illness that you don't know when it will flare up. You can only do what you can do based on what's happening in the moment. And I'm wondering, like, have you, Julia, found that, like, kind of allowing in the fact that you're not always going to be able to control your mental health, even if you have the best meds and the best psychiatrist, you're not always going to be able to control what happens. Like, do you feel like that awareness has, like, does that ability to sit with that lack of control, has that shown up in other parts of your life, whether in parenting or if you've had grief around something else, or, you know, things happening with work that you can't control? Does it feel like it's been a useful exercise?
Yeah. So what I will say is, for me to make sense and meaning in this world, after having seen and experienced what I've experienced, requires me to live through basically every day as if it's my last day. Like, this is my last day. Like, this is the day that we're living for. This is the moment that we're living for. I am no longer planning 6 months, a year, 5 years down the line. I cannot. Like, knowing that my episodes can come at any moment, like, that's like high anxiety for me. And so I literally live in the moment now. I only live in today. The second thing I have to do every day is gratitude and having a moment of like real grace every day, and basically an appreciation of being alive, because I feel like I have faced death many times. I have been to, you know, war with myself and with my mind. So having that moment of grace is very important on a daily basis. So that's what I've had to do post episode.
That's Julia and Mark Lukacs. Julia says she now has the right antipsychotic medication on hand if her sleep routine fails her. And that routine still includes Harry Styles. If you or someone you love is struggling with a mental health crisis or the risk of suicide, start finding help by calling 988, the National Mental Health Crisis Line in the U.S. Death, Sex, and Money is a listener-supported production of WNYC Studios in New York. This episode was produced by Zoe Azoulay with help from Afi Yellowduke. The rest of the team is Liliana Maria Percy-Ruiz, Lindsay Foster-Thomas, and Andrew Dunn. Our intern is Ellie McKay. The Reverend John Delore and Steve Lewis wrote our theme music. The show is on Instagram at Death, Sex, Money, and I'm there at Anna Sale Pix. That's P-I-C-S. And subscribe to our weekly newsletter if you haven't already. I write a weekly essay there. And as we've told you, our show is in transition here at WNYC, and we are sharing updates about the future of the show there, along with other things the team and I are thinking about. Sign up to get that newsletter every week at deathsexmoney.org/newsletter. Thank you to Alicia Baylog in Chicago, Illinois, for being a member of Death, Sex, and Money and supporting us with a monthly donation. We could not do this without you, Alicia, and all of our sustaining members. Thank you. I'm Anna Sale, and this is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com. From the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
I want to thank you for listening and for all your support as we at Death, Sex, and Money have made our move to Slate. Your stories, voice memos, and emails have meant so much to the team. As part of this transition, there's a new way to support our show financially at Slate, our new home, and you'll get something special in return. Subscribe to Slate Plus, and you'll not only support our work on Death, Sex, and Money, you'll get access to new benefits, including listening to us and all of the other great shows Slate makes, like Slow Burn and Decoder Ring,
without any ads or sponsor breaks. To subscribe, just click Try Free at the top of the Death, Sex, and Money show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/DSM+ to get access wherever you listen. Thanks.